Okay, so I'm very happy to be here at a New York ESD users group. I don't see that many familiar faces from 2005, but that's okay. I like to meet people, so afterwards come by and talk to me. Today's talk is going to be on how to get started in kernel programming. And we have a small enough group here. Can everybody hear me back? Okay, we have a small enough group here that I'm hoping that this can be like an extended discussion. How many people here have ever looked at the system source? Okay, so this talk is aimed at people that have never ever looked at the system source and just want to get started. However, there should be enough content in here for you too. There are two prerequisites you need. Actually, let me introduce myself first. So I first got started in BSD programming because I went to Berkeley around the time that 4.2 and 4.3 BSD was being developed. Now, you've heard the saying that you're the sum product of all your experiences and your decisions, right? So maybe if I'd gone to MIT, I'd be a Lisp programmer, but I didn't, so that's why I'm here today. Actually, if I'd gone to MIT, I'd probably be a quant, and I probably wouldn't be here at all, because I'd be, you know, I don't know, Fiji or something, or Cayman Islands.
Or jail, yes.
Well, actually, I need to figure out which countries don't have an extradition treaty. And then I need to book my one-way ticket in advance. I see someone's been doing some investigation. So at that time, you know how there's a hierarchy in computer science? People, just like there's a hierarchy in physical science. Physics at the top, then chemistry, and then maybe a little near the bottom, sociology and psychology. And so in computer science, there tends to be a hierarchy where operating systems, compilers, and those the older topics tend to, for rightly or wrongly, have a higher status and attract more people. But what I'm here to tell you today is that kernel programming is no easier, no harder than any other programming, any other aspects of programming. In fact, if you're a good programmer in any field, you should be able to do. You should be able to program in the kernel. There's certain things that are different, but that's just domain knowledge. You can pick that up as you go along. So there are prerequisites you need before you get started programming the kernel. First, you need to know C. How many people here don't know C but know a scripting language like Python, Perl, Bash, or PHP? Okay, so you still have to learn C. And there's only one book you need to read to learn C, and that's KNR. When you go to the bookstore and you look for C books, you might not see that many, but you see lots of C++ books. Why is that?
More cancer than
that. It's because if Stroustrop had written a book as good as KNR, there would be no need for any other C++ book. And so KNR is really the only C++ book you need. I mean, the only C book that you need. In fact, you should read it cover to cover and memorize it. The second thing is you need two machines. In the old days, when machines were pretty expensive, like $500,000, we got by with one. But that was rather dangerous because at some point, you don't know when, but I guarantee you it will happen. You will trash your file system, then your machine won't boot, and you need to recover from tape, and you never want to do that. Fortunately, machines are very cheap now. You can buy a spare PC for a few hundred dollars, or what I do is I use virtual machines. And you'll see that today when I switch to my BSD virtual machine to show you some of the source code. The first thing you need to do even before you start is you have to learn how to configure and build the kernel. How many people have never done that before? Everyone's done that before, right? So we'll go over this very quickly. There's a config file, you edit it, you take out options, and you just go in the kernel directory, type make. And so it's very simple. You need to type make install and reboot. Nowadays, it turns out that there's a lot of information floating around. When I started, there was nothing. I mean, Kirk McCoy hadn't even written his book yet. And at Berkeley, you learn sort of by apprenticeship. You're in the basement terminal room, and there are people that know what you need to know, and you ask them, and you hope they'll tell you. So there was one guy, he knew everything, but he wouldn't tell me anything. Later on, this guy went on to become a founder of VMware, so he's doing very well.
Can everybody hear in the back?
Sort of, okay, so let's be a little loud. So the first thing you need to read, become very familiar with, is the BSD man page. Note I said BSD. If you look at the man page for Linux and BSD and you compare them, you'll see a vast difference in quality and content. So you definitely want to look at the BSD man page. And in particular, when you're looking at a man page, you're looking at something different than what you would as a user. As a user, you're looking at the API, the calling arguments, the order, and what you have to pass down, the return type. As a kernel programmer, you're actually focused on a lot more on the error no section, the borderline cases, because a lot of what you'll be doing is detecting and checking errors. So, in addition to the man page, you can also look at the POSIX specs, or for networking, you can read the development RFC. It's very important that you read the spec in the RFC, more so than when you're just doing normal programming, because a lot of times a user will come to you and say, hey, this, you know, my program, your OS is buggy, but then you point to the spec and you say, no, actually, we implemented it correctly, it's your program. And as for the RFC, there are a lot of books on networking, and a lot of books that explain TCP/IP, but as an implementer, you still have to read the RFC, because none of them go over all the details and all the border cases that's in the RFC. When we look at some of the source code, you'll see that a lot of the code is to detect the edge cases. The actual handling is very simple. There's a lot of online resources that are available to you. The FreeBSD handbook is fantastic. If you haven't checked it out, you should definitely check it out. I've included the URL below. I have a link there to the Dragonfly BSD handbook, but they're all good. You can look at either one or preferably both. Let me just pull that up really quick to show you what's available there. So, is that available to everyone?
Yeah, you gotta shift the scroll bar on the bottom over.
Yeah, that's because I...
Resolution.
So... let's go back. Oh no. Oh, that would be bad. Okay, so apparently I can't get a network. But that's okay.
It's just SUS. It's a public open network. It's SUS something.
Yeah.
Online. Yeah, that's it. Yep.
So why isn't this working?
IP config.
Maybe your site's down. Just kidding.
All right.
I had to do that.
Just to prove that. Here we go.
Of course that's true.
That's going to work, right? All right, there you go. Now, anyway, I encourage you to look at the handbook yourself. There's a variety of information there. I actually have one here, which is on how to analyze the crash dump, how to do kernel debugging. I'll let you read that. In your copious spare time. What I actually hope to do today is actually give you a taste and get you started. I sort of feel like a drug dealer. The first hit is free. So let's get back to where I was. A theme that will recur over and over again is it's important that you read the source code. Yes?
Do you have any, besides the RFCs for IP, for TCP,
so what are you trying to do?
No, I'm just curious, generally, to get as good
an overview as you can. So for overview TCP/IP, I recommend either Stephen's book or Doug Comer's book. But the problem with any of those books is they explain how it works at the protocol level, but not so much what you need to know to implement it, because there's a lot more detail than that. So you can read, for example, RFC 793 on TCP, and you need to memorize that one. And in fact, if you know that, then you're pretty much okay. There's a lot more follow-ons for congestion control and they silly window and a bunch of other things that they've added. So RFCs, they evolve. They keep adding to them. There's like thousands of them. And so you just need to read the core ones, and the core ones are listed in the index as a standard. So the ones that are standard you have to read.
Which index are you talking about?
There's an RFC index where they go, where they list all the indices.
6,000 RFCs, so.
Okay, and then, and they list some as standard or experimental or obsolete, or, you know, and so there's some core ones that are standard.
Right, and it's like 500 core.
Okay, read 793.
I got it, I've already read it.
You already read it?
Yeah.
You understand it?
I'm working.
No,
I have homework. I'm trying to get like, you know, you have a lot of domain expertise.
Okay.
I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, if you're going in and you're diving in, you want to start, you know, when I get a general base of knowledge. Uh-huh. You know.
So these are just the ones that I have cached in red, but the important ones are the early number ones here.
I guess this does bring up another question, though, because a lot of like networking protocols don't necessarily have or don't go through the IETF, don't have RFCs.
Which one are you talking about?
Like SMB is not a good example, but there are AppleTalk, for example, has some kernel support, but I don't think there's an RFC. I'm sure there are others, but it's been a long time since I've thought about it.
But correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, if there weren't open standards.
I see quite a few AppleTalk RFCs.
Is it open? Yeah. AppleTalk? Was it open?
I don't know.
So why would there be an RFC?
Well, I mean, there are other standards bodies besides the IETF.
The answer to your question is, most of what we have in our source tree is standard-based. We do have AppleTalk.
Uh-oh.
And,
you just hit something.
What? I lost it.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. So we do have some stuff that's not standard here, but if you want to implement that, you would have to get the spec for that yourself and then add the code to our tree. So you would know better where to find the spec for your proprietary protocol.
To, like, add to that, like, having implemented a couple of RFCs, you know, like having had to read them and implement them myself, like a number of RFCs are like core protocol specs, and then they have additions that get, you know, tacked on that aren't necessarily, you know, you don't have to do it all at once. And in a lot of the cases where one RFC requires another one, as you read the RFC, it'll point back to the originating one. And you can use that as a kind of reverse.
I guess what I was really getting at is if you're going to start doing. Looking for the form of knowledge that surrounds the FreeBSD kernel, the Dragonfly kernel, there's probably 10, 20 RFCs that would be good. And so it's obviously in order to be read. And you don't want to be reading all, you know.
Okay,
so. The documents referred to IRFCs, or the source code refers to specific RFCs.
I mean,
let me give you a very quick answer to that, and then we can give you more detail later. But you need to read 793. You need to read the TCP one. You need to read the IT one, which is 792 or 791, right? You don't really need the 792. You need to read the UDP one, but that's very simple. That's just adding a port, right? And then there's a host standard. It's like 1.1 something. This is a host requirement one, which you need to read. This is all for TCP IT, but basically the OSI TCP wars are over. TCP has won.
No, but this is all IPv4 too.
So there are IPv6 RFCs you can read, but those are not as well written. And when you're getting started, start with IPv4 before you even get into IPv6. So at this moment, I said earlier that you should refer to the source code, and that's really important because. One of the advantages of open source is that you can actually compile and modify the source code, and you actually do a lot more reading than you do writing. I want to give a brief overview on where you would start looking, because the source tree is huge. And so the kernel source tree lives in user source sys, on every system. If you look at, you should start with the header files. And there's a whole bunch of them here. One of the exercises that Kurt McCusick makes you do when you take his classes, you have to read every single file and write a one sentence description of what that file describes. You may or may not want to do that, but you should look through a significant portion of these header files and go through that exercise. What you're looking at when you look at the .h file is which structures are defined in that header file. And then after you've done that exercise, you want to go look in the current directory, and you want to look through some of the routines here. This is where the heart of the kernel lives. In particular, the scheduler is here, and the VFS routines are here, prefix of the VFS. And some of the major kern infrastructure are in kern underscore. My screen's blank. Okay. And so that's the kern directory. Now the first header file you need to read in the sys directory is q.h. How many of you are familiar with the q.h macros? Okay, so this is a rite of passage. Everyone needs to read this file. These
are
not
again.
Oh no.
That's back again.
Okay, so actually you can't read that anyways. When you go home, the first header file you should read is q.h. These macros are used all over the kernel. You should be very familiar with their usage, and also it's very interesting to go through their implementation. One of the things you should do is get a paper and draw through some of these list manipulations. And then you need to do that once, then you never need to do it again. Then you just use the calling API. The calling API is defined in the man page when you say man q. So read the man page, read q.h. Perhaps I'm scrolling too fast. Look at the usage examples of q.h here in the bottom. And then as an exercise, go in the kern directory, which I talked about earlier, and look for usages of the list macros. Right, so look at the uses of the list macros. Make sure you understand how they're used, and you could actually go a long way toward understanding the kern directory. One comment I want to make was that there's actually two versions of a lot of these iterators, the for each macros. And the one that I'm thinking of is, if you see a for each underscore safe, that means that you are modifying the list in the loop. Right. Excuse me. Safe is FreeBSD. So FreeBSD calls their for each safe their loop when you modify the list. In Dragonfly BSD, I ported that over and I call that for each mutable because you're mutating the list. Right, so those are some of the uses where you're walking the list and then you're modifying the list as you're walking it, so you have to use a special version of the loop construct. And you can look for other examples in the kernel. So
is that due to re-entrancy concerns, or is that due to
when you read q.h, you'll see that when you're walking the list, you have to remember the next pointer. If you free the element that you're pointing to, then your next pointer may not be valid. Right. And so the safe or the mutable versions will save the next pointer before it allows you to access the loop.
You're not expected to manage the pointer by hand?
You're not expected to manage the pointer by hand.
Okay.
Which is why these macros are great, because you don't have to do any list manipulation. And in fact, one of the things that we do is we take q.h and we move it to user land, and then we use q.h in user land programs. Who needs STL?
Could you speak up a little bit?
Sure.
Just because every time they open the door, we miss like six words and then get confused.
Did you say
Q.H?
Q.H.
Q.
Q.
Quincy.
Okay. This one. I actually speak 400 words a minute, so if you miss six, you're okay. And
you handle missing six.
Could you speak up?
No.
No. Okay. Was that a question? So, I said before that you should read the source code. The other thing you should do is you should do a project. How many of you have heard the saying that if you see something, you might you'll forget 90% of it. If you hear it, you forget 80%. If you write it down and you take notes, you remember 70%. But if you actually do something with it, then you remember it, right? So if you really want to learn the kernel, you should do small projects. So as you're reading the code, here's some sample projects you can do. And I'll give you I'll give you some hints on how to get started on all of these. So the first thing you do is you should write your own system call. And that's when you know you're a kernel programmer. When you have your own system call that prints high. The other thing you should do is, this is a BSDism, actually Linux has adopted it, but you should write a syscuttle. And there are a lot of things you can do with custom syscuttles. You can print out counters, you can add debugging variables, and you can access it from userland through the syscuttle mechanism. The third thing you should do is you write a pseudo device driver. You don't actually need a hardware device to do this, and it's kind of fake. That's why you should call it like slash dev niptuck, and then you can have it. When you do this, you learn the device driver entry points: open, rewrite, close, auto, and so forth. And another thing you can do is you can write a loadable kernel module. You can do this either for a device driver or for a system call or any number of things. But first, write the basic ones, and then do it in a loadable module. We talked about a system call, but there are actually many ways in the kernel. We talked about system calls and syscuttle. You can also make an iopto, or you can add a slash proc entry. And all of these will allow you to add code to the kernel. And then you'll really be, so if you use all of those, then you'll really be a kernel programmer. Let's talk a little about a system call. How many of you know how a system call is made? Alright, so there are actually several ways to get the processor to switch to system mode. The one that we use in BSD is an interrupt. I'm going to show you the code for that, which is in libc. Is that going to go blank again? That's okay, let me just go there.
It might work better if it weren't full screen.
If it was or was not full screen?
If it was not full screen.
We could try that.
Yeah, it's the same.
Okay. So in user source lib slash libc, if you look in the i386 directory, there's two header files. One is sys.h and dev.h. If you look in sys.h, this is how a system call is made. It's actually a macro which calls a bunch of assembly instructions. And you can read through this, you know, later. But the important line is here, which is kern call. That makes an interrupt to vector 0x80. And when your user land program executes that interrupt, you're going to switch to kernel mode. And the code for that in the i386 directory, but we're not going to go over that. Let me show you the place in the kernel that you have to modify to add a system call. So back over to the system directory. So syscalls.master in the kern directory is the list of all the system calls in your system. So you can see here things like send message, accept, read, write, and so forth. And to add a system call, you would edit this file, go to the very bottom, maybe 510 or 600, you should leave some gap, and add my system call, or Jeffrey's call, or whatever your name is. And then you can regenerate that by running the make syscalls .sh script, and that will generate the right header file so that you can call this system call in userland. This is actually documented. In the FreeBSD handbook, which we can't get to because I'm not a network. But if you look in the FreeBSD handbook, there's a great description on how to add a system call, and you can read that later. Trap.c is the lower level code in the kernel that handles interrupt. Let's skip that for now. One thing I wanted to mention is that when you're making a system call, you have to be careful to validate the arguments that the user passes in. So it's not a regular regular function call. You have to copy in and copy out the arguments. Let's take a look at that real quick. So here's an example of some random system call. And the first thing you do when your system call gets called is you copy in all the arguments from user space. And the reason you want to do that is because the user could have passed you a bad pointer, a pointer to some random address or maybe some other processes. Address, you just don't know what it's pointing to, and so you copy it in, and then you check to see if there's an error. If you passed in a bogus pointer, then you return an error, which is usually eval. So you always have to copy in your arguments. When you want to return the result, you have to copy it back out. And you can see, as an exercise, when you get home, look through some system calls and look at where they use copy and where they use copy out. The other thing you have to do when you're validating your system call is you have to make use of descriptors, because if the user who knows why we use file descriptors? And the reason we use file descriptors is that it's an extra level of indirection. When they pass down a file descriptor, there's a file descriptor table where you can make sure they pass down a valid descriptor. If they pass down a pointer, then they could point down any garbage and maybe cause you to crash by dereferencing some bad memory. So in the kernel, there are a number of places where we use descriptors. When you look through the system call API, you should try to find the places besides file descriptors, besides file operations where you use the descriptors. So for example, sockets are a type of descriptors. Some of the shared memory segments are descriptors, and there are other places in the kernel. In the kernel system call API, where we use descriptors. So when you're writing or designing your own system call, you may or may not need an extra level of indirection to protect yourself from bad arguments. The other thing when you're looking through system code is you're going to see a lot of considerations for locking that you won't have in userland. And the theory of locking is that you want to protect some data from concurrent access. And the simplest type of lock is a spin lock. This is where you constantly check to see if someone else is using that variable. The second class of locks is a mutex lock. This is where you check to see if someone is using that data. If someone is, then you invoke the scheduler and you context switch away. And so you use spin locks for critical sessions that you think will be very short, so that if you just wait a little while, someone else will release it. If you know that someone's going to be holding it for a long time, then you call the scheduler and let somebody else run. I'm going to give an example. I'm going to show an example here of sleep as a race condition that can occur. And you will see uses of sleep all over the kernel. So let me just find a good one. This is an obscure one. Let's go find a... All right, so.
Can you explain what a race condition is?
Yes, in fact, that's what hopefully this example will do. Here's one. So, what this is you acquire a lock, then you're checking some condition if something is null. If it is, you're going to sleep. And the second argument to sleep is a spin lock. And the spin lock is the lock that you just acquired. This will atomically release the lock and wait until somebody wakes you up. And you can read that in the man page here for sleep and wake up. So there's a sleep call and then there's the wake up calls. And this is the basic synchronization inside the kernel. And in this example here, right here, if we had simply done a spin unlock. All right, so we'll wait a little while I'm typing. Is it back? And this kernel does video.
It's active.
You know that more?
That's the race condition. You gotta run the third chase and get home.
Without getting thrown out.
How's that?
Okay, so.
Thank you.
Sure. So, here, right here, if we did an unlock and then we did a regular sleep, what could happen is, right after we check to the condition that we're interested in, we want something on this list. If now we're going to sleep and wait for someone to add something to the list. If someone added to the list here, right before we did the sleep, now you have a race condition. Now you're going to go to sleep. You're going to sleep until someone adds to the list, right? Which is the check here. You're gonna sleep until someone adds something to the list. The only problem is here, if an insertion occurs, then you have a lost wake up. Because somebody did a wake up, no one's waiting, and now you go to sleep forever. So the typical solution for this, and you'll see this over the kernel, is you call S-sleep, which atomically releases your spin lock, and then goes to sleep. And in case this wasn't completely clear, you can always go home and look for all the occurrences of S-sleep and try to figure it out. Or there's an excellent book on this, which I have in my references. And it's Kurt Schimmel's book, Unix Systems for Modern Architecture, where he talks all about locking. It's very simple, so it's very accessible, and he talks about lost wakeups and race conditions. So I showed you one example, one place in the kernel where a lost wakeup could occur, and the solution for that, but Kurt's book talks all about that. So far we talked about system calls, we talked about some of the ways that a system call is different from a normal library call. You have to do copy in, copy out, you have to use descriptors and validate arguments, you have to watch out for locking. So at this point, you should know enough to go and try and write your own system call. If you look at the man pages, the handbook, and look at the source. Before I go on to the next section, are there any questions? Comments? So, actually, a very interesting thing to do before you write your own system call is you go in the source tree and you type a print, just add a print statement somewhere when some condition occurs. And then you compile kernel and then you run it and then you try to invoke that print statement and you can see it in the console. At that point, you've modified the kernel and you can start doing basic debugging. I'm going to give a very quick overview of some of the more interesting modules in the kernel, and as you go through you can read in more detail. So the first one I'm going to start with is the VM subsystem. The purpose of the VM subsystem is to manage user address spaces. It takes page faults and it brings pages in and then it wakes up the user process. There's a very interesting use of red-black trees in there. I'm going to point that out just to give a taste. Is that going to go blank again? Alright, so in the sys directory, if you look at tree.h, This is even more complicated than Q.H. There's a splay tree in there, which FreeBSD uses for their VM data structure. Dragonfly and NetBSD, we use a red-black tree, and Linux also uses a red-black tree, which is in here. You can read about this in any data structure book, and then you can compare whatever you read in the algorithm book with the implementation that we have here. You can look through the VM code, which lives in sys/VM. And you can look for uses of red-black trees. So here's an example in a VM map where we have an entry to a red-black tree. And you can, and so here's some uses here where we're removing and adding elements to the red-black tree, walking down the left and right node. So this is in vmap.c, where we're looking up an entry. So, and the very best the very best description of the VM system is Matt's write-up, which is available from the FreeBSD website here. Let me see if I have a copy of that cached. Yeah, right. So, in this write-up, you can read all about the FreeBSD VM subsystem.
Shift F5.
It's gone?
Shift F5.
So, for those of you that are interested in networking, the very best reference for this is Stevens Volume 2. It's a very thick book. I actually read the whole thing through. Use it as a pillow, because it tells you everything. The code for the networking stack is inside the net star directories, obviously. Someone was asking about TCP/IP, about IPv6. That would be here, net996, but I suggest you not look at this, because it's horrible. So start with net and net inet. Actually, I would start with net inet. Out of all these files, start with the IP files first, like IP input and IP output. And if you read the IP protocol, these should be pretty straightforward. It's amazing how much junk I've accumulated in these files in 20 years. So the trick to reading this is to ignore all the special cases and all the ifs and go try to figure out the next call that it makes. So for example, for IP output, the main point of IP output is called ether output. So it does like a ton of stuff. So here's IP output. It does like a ton of stuff for divert routing and a bunch of stuff. And then at the very end, which is, this is like a 1,000-line routine, at the very end here, we're gonna go, this is all one function, by the way. We're gonna go all the way to the bottom. This is still one function. Aha. We call. Right here, we call IF output. That's what's called ether output. So you do like thousands of lines of code, and then you make a call down to the next stack to pass it on to the ethernet layer. So who knows why? So all the BSD networking routines have thousands of lines of code. Do you know why that is? It's because in the old days, a function call was very expensive. So they wrote their whole code to not make any function calls. It was all, straight line code. The problem with that is you only have 60, 100 lines on your screen. And so by the time you get to this very bottom here, you've forgotten what, you were doing up top. This is why printouts are very valuable when you're working with networking code. Because with printouts, you can spread out on the table and you can look at 10 pages at a time. So the trick when you're reading this networking code is figure out the control flow in terms of calling structure. Which routine calls what? And where it passes on to the next level. And all the processing stuff you can pretty much skip over on the first pass. So out of these, actually the networking stack is bigger than the rest of the kernel. So people talk about embedded systems and how small they get, because all they do is they have a scheduler, but they don't do networking. Once you put in networking, then they're just as big as BSD. So you might as well just use BSD for your embedded system anyways if you're going to do any sort of networking. So look at IP input and IP output. And then the next file to read is the TCP input and TCP output. These are also humongous files. And the trick here is the structure of TCP input and TCP output exactly follows RFC 793. So if you read that RFC, you can exactly see the control flow for TCP input and output. The next thing is, if you look in the net directory, this is where Ethernet processing is done. In particular, the one file is ifethersubword.c. And this is where we construct the Ethernet frame and pass it down to the device driver. So again, I talked about figure out the next step in the processing. So the next step of Ether output is going to pass it on to the device driver. If you go all the way to the bottom of this file, you'll see that it calls down to the NIC driver. That's all I'm going to say on networking at this time, but obviously it's a very interesting field and I've done a lot of work there, so if you want to talk about it, you can come talk to me afterwards. Another large kernel subsystem you might be interested in is the VFS subsystem. The way to get into this system is you first look at the header file and you look at struct vnode, which is here. And so you, so in this struct vnode, read through here, look through some of the fields. You'll see uses of, here you see uses of q.h, that's the tail queue and the list entry macro, so you see that all over the kernel. And then, after you've read vnode.h, you can go through and look in the kernel directory and look through the VFS files, which are here. In particular, look at VFS vnode-ops and vops.c, which is here. Vnode-ops.c. And this is the file where it takes a generic vnode and calls down to the underlying file system. So this file is pretty critical. The underlying file systems are here in the VFS directory. This is a bit of a misnomer. Linux calls this the FS directory, which is actually a better name for it. Did I just say something good about Linux? Okay, someone turn off the tape recorder. And so in the VFS directory, there's a bunch of file systems. The file system you should start with is a null file system, because this is the very simplest file system. It does nothing. If you and when you read this, it gives you a structure of what operations you need to implement in order to implement a file system. And the next file system to read after you've done that is to read the UFS file system. And there's a classic paper on UFS and FFS which you should read, and this code here pretty much follows that. If you're interested in say the memory allocator in the kernel, the code for that is in the main current directory. You want to read kernmalloc.c, so Mac calls this slab allocator, but it's not really a slab allocator. This is just a generic memory allocator. You can read through this memory allocator. This actually uses the kmalloc and kfree API, which you can read in the man page. And so read the man page, read the header file, then read the implementation. The other thing to look, the other interesting thing here is all the BSDs, or FreeBSD and Dragonfly BSD in particular, have a slab allocator. We call ours the object cache. And so, this is a very interesting code, and not just because I wrote it. This is actually an idea taken from SunOS. There's a lot of cross-fertilization from across all the BSDs. There's a Usenix paper on the slab allocator which you should read before you read this code. So we looked at the cybernetic code. Let me show you the header file. It'll show up in a second, don't worry.
What?
All right, so in mallet.h, this is...
Could you explain what a slab allocator is?
A slab allocator was a Sun microsystem invention, which they put in Sun OS, and the idea is you grab a whole page, whole chunk of memory from the underlying system, then you break it up into equal-sized objects of the same type. And when you do an allocation, the idea is objects of the same type have the same lifetime. So if you do an allocation of that type of object, you will free it at pretty much the same time. So all the objects in a page get allocated and freed pretty much at the same time, and therefore you can then free that page back to the underlying system. Otherwise, what you get is you get a fragmentation. You have a page which you've broken up and you've given away different objects in that page, but there's one that's still outstanding. Everything else has been freed, but there's one object that's still allocated, and therefore you cannot free up that entire page. And so the slab allocator was meant to solve the fragmentation problem. And it does that by breaking up a page into objects of the same type. Another thing that the object cache does is it caches pre-constructed objects. So you construct an object, then you initialize all the fields, and then you allocate it. Now, when you free the object, you free it in initialized format. You restore it back to the initialized form, then you free it. And so the next time someone allocates it, you don't have to do the initialization. This is a gain if when you free an object, you have to deconstruct it. You have to free up all the locks. You have to decrement all the rep counts back down to zero. At which point, you have an object that looks, you have an old free object that looks almost like a new object. And so that way you can save on having to reinitialize it the next time you allocate it. And if you read the slab allocator paper, it turns out that most of the savings, most of the speedups are from not having to do the initialization. The allocation itself is faster, but it's not having to initialize the pre-constructed object where you get the most gains. And so, did that answer your question?
Does that answer your question, Mark? Didn't have a question, just
looked
like some other people were asking.
Okay, and so...
I don't know everything.
that's okay. that's okay because I don't know everything either, and what I do know, most of which I've forgotten, so... the stuff I've forgotten is a large percentage of what I've learned, so I actually remember less than what I've learned. One point I want to make about the kernel memory allocator is make sure you read malloc.h. In particular, if you look at these flags, you'll notice that when you pass down a flag to malloc, you can tell whether or not you want to wait. And that's because in the kernel, there are certain places where you don't want to block, like in an interrupt handler. And so when you're doing a memory allocation inside the interrupt handler, you have to pass a special flag that says, don't wait. All the other places, like when you're doing a system call, which is what we call the top half of the kernel, you can do a kernel memory allocation. If there's no memory, it will wait. It will block there until somebody frees up memory. This extra flag argument here to kmalloc, which you don't see in the user land version of malloc.
There wasn't asynchronous version of malloc where you can malloc and pass a callback or something along those lines.
There is not an API like that in the kernel. That would be interesting though, that's called a continuation. You can actually use that infrastructure in other places besides malloc. You can use it in all sort of blocking points.
Yep.
But we don't have that in any of the BSDs. There are some research operating systems that use continuation, but not BSD and not Linux.
Do any OSs do that?
Yes, so there are some research operating systems that do use continuation as their basic structuring mechanism. I don't recall off the top of my head, but if you come to me afterwards, I can mail you the paper once I find it. Another very interesting facility inside the kernel is the scheduler. Let me show you the source code for that. It's And once again, I recommend that you start by reading the header files, which would be sked.h. And there's not a lot there. It basically defines these scheduler API. And then what do we do next? We go look in the current directory and look for all the scheduler files. And the first scheduler file you should read is the null scheduler, which is usked.dummy. The null scheduler is the very simplest scheduler you can do. It does basic round robin. It shows you all the calls you need to implement, all the calls you need to write to implement your own scheduler. So a learning project would be for you to write your own scheduler, use this file as a template, and you could do a very simple scheduling policy like random. You just randomly pick a process. Now, you wouldn't use this in a production system, but you don't really have to worry about deadlock, you don't have to worry about starvation, because at some point, if you're randomly picking processes, then at some point that process will run. You might not like the interactivity that you get, but you can actually boot that kernel and you can actually see it working. That's what I'm going to say on the scheduler. You can play with that on your own. There's actually a lot of good documentation available now. I wish they had this, 10, 20 years ago, but they didn't. So you're very lucky. The first one is, and I recommend this book to everybody, is Bahalia's Unix Internals. This book is fantastic. And obviously because we're using BSD, actually McCusey has a new one out called the Design Implementation of the Free BSD Operating System, but these two are very similar. So McCusey's book is obviously a very good book, but I would read that after you've looked through the source code, because there's a lot of detail in Kirk's book, which is going to be hard to understand unless you've looked around. Yes?
That version of McCusey's book for FreeBSD is obsolete. You need a newer version. It doesn't follow. That's
You need to talk to Kirk about that.
I did. That's who told. Well, it was Kirk. It was George Neville Neal who told me.
No. You need to talk to Kirk about that. Not George.
No, they have a new edition now.
Oh, okay.
That's the old edition.
Oh, no. Right. I said that. I said there's a newer version out, but, if you compare the two, actually most of the description is the same. There's only a few places that they've changed. And finally, I mentioned the Kurt Schimmel's book, which is very good for its description of locking. Okay, so at this point, I've tried to give an overview of some of the major subsystems. We've looked at how to get started reading the code. Described some projects that you can do to learn by doing. And I'm going to open the floor up for questions. Yes?
So you talked about one type of VM, and I was surprised to see you doing development on another type of VM, virtual machines.
Uh-huh.
What impact does VMs have, if any, and where do you see the kernel going because of it?
So that's very interesting, because so the question was
memory.
Right, so the question that Hans has was,
that's why I said he's using, yes, talking about one type of VM, uh-huh, and he's using it.
For posterity, the question was, I mentioned VM in the sense of virtual memory. What about VM in the sense of virtual machines? In Dragonfly BSD, we have something called a vkernel, where you can run a Dragonfly instance inside another Dragonfly kernel. And what Matt did there was he manipulated the VM page tables so that your user level process looked like another operating system. And this is at a higher level than VMware does it, for example. VMware emulates the raw hardware. Zen, this is closer to, this is even above the Zen layer, where you provide a API for the hypervisor. It turns out that there are various places where an OS can interact with the virtual machine, either by modifying the virtual memory system, by providing a layer to the hypervisor, or by doing nothing and letting the virtual machine emulate a raw hardware. So the answer to your question is, it depends, the VM could do nothing, or, I mean the OS could do nothing different, or it could do something radically different. to implement virtual machines. A very interesting thing is for I/O, this is one place where the OS can make changes that will have significant impact on performance. This is where hypervisors can make their large performance claims, is because they can do more efficient I/O than you can emulating the raw hardware.
So, I mean, do you see like a fundamental shift in the way kernels were written because, or will be modified and written because of VM, or do you, is it really up to the hypervisor to deal with it?
So the question was, do I see a big change in the way OS is written due to virtual machine technology? And the answer is yes. Virtual machines have had a large impact on in recent years, but a lot of that impact, it has impact in the OS structure. We saw that with Xen and hypervisors, and also with the with vkernel. We see its impact in hardware. There are people making NICs that more efficiently support virtual machines. Basically, it gives you a virtual NIC for each of your virtual machines. So this is a case where the hardware is cognizant of the fact that you're running in a virtual environment, and it tries to provide support for your virtual environment. Most of the hardware NIC vendors are supporting VMware, so that your VMware networking would be much more efficient if you bought their card. But that's an impact more, not so much on the OS, because OS still thinks it's talking to a regular NIC. The impact there is more at the hardware and at the VM hypervisor level.
Would it be more at the device driver layer? Or power virtualized drivers and all that other stuff that, as far as I understand, goes along?
And so philosophically, so the question was, is there any impact on device drivers? And my opinion on that is that philosophically, virtual machine, VM technology is best when it's invisible. If you're aware that you're running a virtual machine, if you have to do something different, then a lot of the benefit from virtual machines go away, because it's supposed to emulate, it's supposed to be invisible, it's supposed to emulate, it's supposed to give you more than one machine without you, you know, having to do anything, without you having to change anything. That's where their, you know, amazing magic occurs. If you have to do something, then it's not so virtual anymore. All right, well, yes in the back?
More of a comment, not on this, but on the books to read section. There's a very good book called Designing Rootkits in FreeBSD. It's basically designed around how to get a high school senior to CS course under his belt, hacking on the FreeBSD kernel. If you want to start, that's an excellent place. It takes you through the whole process of getting a basic rootkit, i.e. a kernel loadable module that does bad things. But, you know, get your basic rootkit set up and everything else, but it takes you through the kernel. It may be a little dated, and I know there's at least one mistake in the C code, but it's a very good book.
So the comment from the back was that there's a very good book on rootkits that's a good introduction to FreeBSD kernel.
Well, it's not a good book on rootkit. It's sort of like a good book on intro to kernel development without having.
We tried to get him to speak. He's in Toronto. Steve knows the deal.
Okay, so the comment in back was that there's a book titled something with rootkit, which is missing.
Designing FreeBSD rootkits, published by NoStar.
Designing FreeBSD rootkits, which is misnamed. It's actually a better introduction to FreeBSD than it is to rootkits. Okay. Any more comments or questions? Yes.
So as somebody who's developed, speaking about you, on different BSDs, what do you think the biggest hang-up is from saying you see something that looks interesting and say NetBSD and you want to put it in OpenBSD or vice versa, you know, copying pieces of infrastructure from one operating system to the other? What stops?
So the question here was how easy or how hard it is to write a subsystem that works across all the BSDs. And
more so, like, why don't we see more sharing of stuff? Because there are subsystems that become kind of pigeonholed to be the FreeBSD thing.
And the follow-up question was, why don't we see more sharing? So those are actually two different questions with two different answers. The answer to the first question is, there are annoying differences between all the BSDs that mean that makes your code non-compilable on a different BSD. For example, in the q.h macro, FreeBSD calls their mutating loop construct for each safe. In Dragonfly BSD, they call it for each mutable. Why can't they just agree on a name? I mean, who's responsible for this mess? So the answer to your question is there are minor annoying syntactical differences that make it difficult. There are also harder underlying problems with their locking philosophies that make it more difficult for one piece of code to work across all the BSDs. BSDs are, kernel code is inherently non-portable. And the secondary question is, why isn't there more sharing? The answer to that is, part of that is because there are technical problems, and a larger part of that is there are social problems. If you could get everyone to get along and play nice, then we would only have one unified BSD, and we would only have one API for everything, and then you know we could all share. But that's never gonna happen. So you know, you might as well hope for world peace instead. You'll get that first.
It's funny because you can. I mean, I'm just curious because you could say it's political or social. You could say it's social or political, and you can know the discussions and debates and things that are going on. But ultimately, a lot of it does look like it does come down to, you know, hard technical questions. Obviously, with the seeds of it could have been what. The seeds of it could have been what they were in the moment and so on, but generally it actually, if you look at the history, despite what happened to USENIX in, you know, 1990 whatever, and all the big kind of incidents along the way, you know, with the mailing list flaming and whatever, it actually still does, in hindsight, if you look at it objectively, I mean, in my opinion, I'd argue, but it does look like technical differences that took place. Just like, and I'll speak to the heart here, or to your heart, you know, Matt, with, you know, Dragonfly.
So George and Beck had a comment. In his opinion, it's mostly the technical differences and not so much the social differences that make it hard for kernel code to be portable. Was that an accurate summary of your view?
I'm sorry?
Was that an accurate summary of your view that most of the
outside of the gloss, I mean, you were embroiled from the beginning, so you would know.
And so right. So there are technical differences. I feel that we can solve the technical differences if we can get past this, if we can work together and get past the social differences. Unfortunately, we're not going to get past the social differences, so we're not going to get to, you know, put our heads together and hash out whatever technical differences we have. So you're going to have multiple solutions, and that's not necessarily bad because. A different system, like OpenBSD has done a lot of good work in security, so if you really care about that, then that system is better suited for your application. So the way I look at it, diversity is actually good. Yes?
Can you actually show us how you would run a modified kernel?
Yeah, sure. How would actually run it?
How you would actually build it and run it.
Okay. So I'm going to give you a very quick overview, which is, if you look in the config directory, you have a bunch of config files. I have one here, which I call VMware. And this is a config file where you have a bunch of, where you configure your kernel. If you wanted to modify it, you could go to kern, and you could pick something like, you could pick a random directory, a random call, and you would say you would place your code here, right? I'm not going to say that. So now you've modified your kernel. You would go into the config file. You would say config the file, and that will generate a directory, a compile directory. You go into that compile directory. You type make, right, that's going to take a long time. You type make install, right? And then you type reboot, at which point you're now running your new kernel.
I see. Like,
if you wanted to have a kernel to debug, like if you wanted to attach your debugger to a kernel.
You can do that in VMware. And you can also use VirtualBox or whatever other virtual kernel you want. What I have is, I created something called a pipe. Right, so I actually just called a pipe here. It's a name pipe. I connect it to my test kernel. Anybody see that, right? And so once I have this, I actually have a serial link, and I can connect KGDB over that virtual serial link. And I can set breakpoints and get stack traces that way. If you're using a different virtual machine like VirtualBox, you would have a different setup, a different dialogue. But the idea is you can set up a serial line. Now, if you actually have a real hardware, which is best, by the way, if you actually have a real box, you just attach either a USB, either a serial line or a FireWire cable, and then you can run KGB through that real serial line.
I'm familiar with the serial version of that. What happens to the FireWire? How do you plug that into on the other end?
So if both machines have a FireWire port, like this laptop here is a FireWire port, yeah, and your test machine is a FireWire port, then you can run KGDB over that device.
So like if you have two BSD kernels on both machines, they have a custom FireWire protocol, they speak. Serial's well known, but I'm not familiar with doing this kind of stuff over
right,
FireWire.
So the short answer is yes, and the usage for that is described in the handbook.
Okay.
And so that's one. And second, a comment I want to make is that FireWire is actually better because the FireWire a processor is still running after your kernel crashes, so you can examine memory even though the rest of the kernel is down.
They're also way cheaper, easier to find.
Well, yeah, the serial stuff is way old. Oh, that said, as I remember, like back in the day, even when this, like if your kernel crashed with and you compiled the right options, your kernel would crash and you had a serial console hooked up to it. Like you could still get like stack traces and spec memory and that kind of stuff. Like most of the time, it would catch itself in such a state that you could look at it. And I didn't often run into cases where it was just posed and I couldn't talk to the debugger at all.
So the question back was, the comment was that serial worked well enough for him in all cases. He didn't have to go to...
This FireWire thing, this is totally new to me. This could be awesome.
The only functionality that FireWire gives you over serial wire is that it might be a little faster and you can examine memory after your system crashes. It actually kind of has a really hard crash, and it no longer accesses. You can no longer run, normal KGDB on it.
Okay.
Yeah. Question in the back.
Related to virtual machines, apart from like dead obvious stuff like IO subsystem, what's surprising kernel subsystems don't debug or map very well when you run a test kernel in a VM compared to running a test kernel on bare metal.
So the question was. Debugging on a real machine versus debugging on a virtual machine.
Or rather, if you're developing, say, drivers, what kind of drivers don't map well behavior-wise, apart from obvious stuff like I/O, when you build on a VM, so you can crash it and just restart the VM, versus when you put it on a real machine?
So the specific question was device driver development on a virtual machine.
Yeah, what sorts of drivers are harder than expected?
And the answer to that is you don't want to debug device drivers in a virtual machine. Because
you try not to. Probably,
no, you can't do it. You can't.
Drivers, other things like the scheduler, which has unusual behaviors, VM, the virtual memory subsystem, or stuff like that.
Okay, and so to expand on that, the reason why you don't want to debug a device driver on a virtual machine is the virtual machine gives you a set of virtual devices. You can't actually access the real, you don't really access the real hardware.
You're faking the devices and you really don't want to build against the fake devices, you want to build on the real ones.
Correct.
But
so
there's other problems
And then the question is, what other problems are there developing in a VM? Actually, there's a whole host of problems. One is your timing is different. So if you're trying to gather performance measurements, you can't gather that on a virtual machine. Another difference is, so we already talked about the devices are different, the timing is different. There's some processor differences between a virtual machine and a real processor. You might not be able to get it at some of the performance counters that the Intel processors have, because the virtual machine doesn't emulate those.
You can mostly use VMware though, right?
You can. I couldn't get access to the performance counters on my version of VMware 5. Maybe they added emulation for that later. But even if they did, they still wouldn't be accurate.
The timings aren't the same,
correct. Even if you could, even if they faked it, I wouldn't believe those numbers. And so another difference is, if you're doing SMP development, running in a virtual machine may or may not give you a faithful reproduction because your timing will be different. VMware does have SMP support, so you can have you can run a multi-processor virtual machine. That didn't used to be the case, and there are some virtual machines that don't support more than one processor. So KVM does or does not. Okay, so KVM supports it now. I know the early version didn't. So again, how closely the virtual machine emulates your real hardware is it's close, but not. Not for some of the performance and low-level hardware things.
You have to remember that. Also, remember things like VMware—they're not bug-free. These things have bugs in them, right? They should be running into bugs in the actual emulator itself.
That's entirely possible. I haven't had that many problems with it, but maybe for a less mature product, that's certainly a danger. A question back.
What are you working on right now?
What am I
just out of curiosity, I mean, inside of Dragonfly or FreeBSD, that would be of interest to us.
Have you heard of high-frequency trading?
Yeah.
What if you have? Then you know I can't say much about it. But
you have to have that ticket to the same bar server.
Question or comment?
But so, I would have thought you've been looking up extradition treaties already then.
So I'm actually in New York and I'm looking for a job doing high frequency trading where they're hiring a lot of kernel programmers. I was going to use that as motivation for people to come to the talk, but since you're already here, you know, I don't have to add any extra motivation. But aside from that, there's actually all sort of jobs that, you know, require kernel that could benefit from having kernel experience. So it's a good thing to get into. And as I said earlier, it's not that hard. There's a bunch of subsystems and a bunch of APIs you have to learn. And you just have to read the code and just get started. You know, do some learning projects. You know, and then you'll be more familiar with the system the more you work with it. And back.
Do you have any comments about if someone wants? I know it's a bit beyond the scope of the talk, but if someone wants to get into doing something unusual, porting BSD to an architecture doesn't currently sufficiently support, and or things like that.
So the question was about porting BSD to different hardware.
Do you have any comments about how easy, how hard,
what kind of
stuff,
right? And So this talk was mainly an introduction to give you a flavor and get your appetite whetted. But when you want to do porting, that's actually a more difficult project. I don't recommend you do that as your first kernel project, but maybe, you know, after a little while, you could do that. The code for that is in a different part of the code than what we looked at. It's in the hardware-specific section, like I386, and there's a bunch of assembler files. My comment on that is this is where you get really close to the hardware. You become very familiar with the hardware and the device driver specs. And you have to, for the most part, the kernel is written in C, as we saw, but the parts that are written in assembly are the parts that you have to write for a port. It typically takes, nowadays, about a month and a couple thousand lines of assembly file to do a port. Unix is very portable. I find that the more interesting ports now are to small embedded devices like cell phones or, refrigerators. So people are now putting BSD in game consoles, you know, in all sort of small embedded devices. And I think that's very interesting. Actually, in the past, the only kernel work used to be device driver porting. But nowadays, there's some work in VM and file systems and networking, so I find that to be slightly more interesting. But if you really like being close to the hardware, then knock yourself out. Get a little game console or a cell phone and try porting BSD to it.
Yeah.
Hans?
Similar questions. What areas of the kernel need help, need work, and what is the status of SMP and threading?
So all the projects have a project a list on their webpage. If you look on there, those are projects that they would like to have volunteers work on. They're always looking for people, and so after you do these small learning projects, you should definitely try to pick up a project on one of their project lists. What is the second part of your question?
I guess it's dependent on the BSD, but what is the status of SMP?
What's the status of SMP? And so the key to SMP is removing the big kernel lock. Pretty much all the BSD have made a great deal of progress toward that, and we're running certain subsystems like networking in parallel now, or you know, out of the big giant lock. And so if you look in Linux, there's still places where they hold the big kernel lock. And so in all the BSDs, there are places where we still hold the giant lock. But
can you speak louder on that? Sorry.
But we're narrowing them down. yes.
Is there a sort of philosophical difference going on? You know, anyone who has some thoughts on this? You know, in Linux, there's definitely a push in certain distributions to really be hopping on the bandwagon in terms of certain virtual machine capabilities, specifically the Amazon AMI image with Xen. But I see that there's stuff in Linux kernel land that's going towards this KVM stuff, and so it seems that there's flux there too. You know, philosophically, the idea of virtual machines, in a sense, depending on how you're thinking about your architecture, actually sort of produce less reliability depending on how you're doing your architecture. But I guess what I'm getting at is, I've seen on the Xen Mr. Previous D that things are sort of hooking a little bit all of a sudden, but it's been a long time, like for Xen. I'm not saying that I know or have a particular view of what should be done or.
So the commenter question was on Xen versus KVM. And my view on that is, the reason why we have a VMware and some of the low-level virtual machine technology was that the x86 processor architecture is very bad. There are certain features that are hard to virtualize. They fixed that in the later versions by adding the VT technology. And so if you take advantage of those, you can actually do better. You can actually get better performance than emulating and trapping those instructions that can't be virtualized. And so, in theory, if you're running a later processor, KVM is better than running some sort of emulating, trapping virtual machine technology.
But, is there a sense of what the community is thinking about these issues in terms of BSD versus, what Linux is done? One of the thoughts is that it's not clear to me that even anytime soon you're going to be able to run a FreeBSD online on.
Okay, so the question was on, is there any consensus on which virtual machine technology is better or best? And the answer is not that I know of, because it turns out at the level that we're looking at is, which one is more interesting, how are they implemented? This isn't really what the user looks at. They're looking at how easy these VMs are to manage. And in that case, VMware has a big lead because they have a lot of, they have much more mature management tools. Than other solutions. So the other solution may be technically better, or they may be faster, but the fact is, if you have thousands of virtual machines, your concern is how easy is it for me to manage and run those, and not so much the 20 or 30% performance gain you get by running a hypervisor versus a virtual machine. So the answer is that battle will probably not be won on technical issues, it'll be won on ease of use and marketing issues. And so far, there's no consensus.
Okay, I guess what I'm really getting at is Linux has had certain things for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And as far as I understand, there's certain things that none of the BSDs have chosen to deploy. And I'm not saying that's bad necessarily. Uh-huh. I'm just observing. I've seen people talking about the fact, one, from a marketing point of view, if nothing else, the fact that BSDs still can't be used in Amazon's architecture, which is still rapidly gaining market share, is an issue. As a community, you choose not to be there, that's fine, but it would be interesting to sort of know where people are.
So the question is on the proliferation of VM technology on Linux that we don't have in BSD. And I believe the answer for that is that we have Xen support in FreeBSD. I think even NetBSD has it, but people are working on Xen and adding Xen support, and that's easy to do because Xen is open source. VMware support is a little harder because the vendor needs to do it. VMware Inc. has to add the support for that, and they are probably not willing to support systems like BSD that doesn't have as large a user base as Linux. As for KVM, I would love to have a KVM, a VT-based solution in the BSDs. It's just that no one's done it yet. So if you're interested, that would be a very good kernel project at some point.
I guess what you're asking is it's a question of certain people deciding to work on certain things, and there's also many people around it so much time.
Yeah, it seems like it's not just like a small issue. It's like, in other words, it's fine to take the position that you choose because maybe you have a different views to what reliability means to not go there. You want to stay on bare metal, that's fine. But it's sort of weird to me that no one's really sort of talking about this. A little bit of stuff coming up on the same panel was literally like the last 3 weeks after nothing for 2 years. Like nothing really.
So the comment was a lack of progress on VM technology in the BSDs. I believe a large part of that is we don't have people like you that are interested in that actually then go and do it, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly, if we had people like you that were interested in it and that did it, we would take it. You know, we would love to have all sort of support that we don't have now. Part of my ulterior motive for giving these talks is try to get more people interested in contributing and adding whatever interesting technology that you know they find fascinating, because they know there's just so much to work on, right? That the people we have is not enough to work on all of them, so.
The same thing could be said for SMB and threading in the past. There was a big laggard, obviously,
that only changes when someone decides to fix it and put the effort through.
Yeah, I just had a question. It's actually more of a Dragonfly question, but it's kind of related to the VMs. I remember a couple years ago, there was one of the project plans was to have a process level abstraction. You could basically run a process in one machine and then kind of, I guess, fail the process over to another machine. Is that still?
So that's called single system image. That's what Matt calls it. He's still interested in doing that. He got sidetracked working on the Hammer file system. He got sidetracked for 2 years working on the Hammer file system. But at some point, you know, so Matt's a very talented programmer and he's a multimillionaire, so he doesn't have to work. And so he just, you know, sits there all day writing code that he likes to write. And so I believe at some point he will get around to writing the SSI image code. And actually, he has a grand plan, and the Hammer file system is part of his plan to get the single system image, because it allows him to serialize and stream the file system protocol across, you know, multiple images. And so he sees this as a stepping stone to getting to a coherent SSI system. So he's this point he's going through and fixing the file system part of getting SSI going. Yes.
This may not be your field of expertise, but could you comment on how difficult it is to port OpenBSD's PF packet filter to Linux? Because I've been waiting for someone to do that for years. And so the comments that I always hear back is like, you know, the differences in the kernel.
Right. So the question.
I don't have the skills for that, but I'm sure. I don't know how hard it is.
The question was on porting the PF from OpenBSD to Linux packet filter, and the. The difficulty there is that, well, the first difficulty you run into is the difference between skbuf and mbus. So we have a different representation for our network packets. But that's a solved problem. People have wrappers, really hideous macros, which will hide the differences between mbus and skbuf, really. But you don't really want to do that. It's really ugly.
A lot of little details that make it hard. Yeah. The way skbufs are used, the way packets are handled, the steps they go through, there are pretty heavy differences between BSD and Linux.
Yeah. Another difficulty is locking. You know, the locking in the BSDs and Linux is very different. And my opinion is it would be easier if you took the packet filter interface, their command sets and APIs, and you re-implemented that.
Yeah, you'd be easier off if you made something that looked like PF from user land using the existing Linux features not working against
it. What's your point? I mean, what is the question about? I don't understand.
I mean, I really like PF, but I make my living as a Linux sysadmin.
He loves that PF, something that acts and breathes like PF on Linux.
So if you're not doing, if you do, you talk about host-based stuff or network-based stuff, because if it's network-based stuff, if your Linux is all network, right? Your whole network is Linux, where the Steam machines are mounted.
Sometimes that's not an option. Yeah. just,
okay, so
I run into IP tables enough that, you know, I hate it.
Do you want that facility bad enough to pay for it?
Fly rule closer.
Not that bad, but
okay.
It would be very nice.
No, the people you can pay that will put that will rewrite a PF.
How much are we talking about?
You'd have to ask them.
I got $40.
I just
put an Etsy Red Hat release file in OpenBSD machine.
See, so here's the thing. OpenBSD is trying to get more users, right? So if you take all their best features and you put them on Linux, then what's the incentive to run a BSD? In fact, all the BSDs have this problem. If you take the best features in the BSD and you port it over Linux, then at some point, you know, you don't actually need to run us anymore. Right?
Yeah, but the best features on kernel, so I port that over to it, and it's a
So actually,
I mean,
a question I should ask you is, why are you running Linux in the first place?
Well, I mean, I run BSD everywhere at home, at the nonprofit stuff that I do.
Uh-huh.
But as a living, you know, I do with Linux systems administration.
Uh-huh.
I've only had one job where I've been a free BSD admin, and everything else is in Linux. So that's where the money is.
Sure. And so Linux got started in enterprise because it was brought there by the sysadmins. And they ran it at home and they brought it to work. And so, you know, if you're a sysadmin, you know, this is a prime opportunity for you to bring BSD into your enterprise.
I actually happen to work in an industry right now where there's a lot of federal directives about, you know, privacy laws and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And so Windows, Mac OS X, and certain flavors of Red Hat are the only approved OSs.
Uh-huh.
So getting free BSD in the door, I mean, there's a lot of covert guys who run BSD, but getting it in officially is... it's much harder than just putting a box in.
The license doesn't matter. It's good.
Just because it's hard doesn't mean you get a fight.
Okay.
So, George, is this going to be here next week or not?
Next one.
The one next week?
No.
You sure? I'll buy the first round.
Also, keep your head count out.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, I'll be here afterwards. You can come by and talk to me. Thank you for
coming.